Good Friday morning and welcome to The Morning Voiced. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and this is the Friday version of Success Stories, where we talk about organizations in Tucson that have done great work and are doing good work today and have a long history in Tucson. Our guests today are Isabel Lucerich and Chris Amadori and Chris Davenport. They're the team from Hopsports Grill, which is located out in East Tucson. Good morning, Isabel.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, Chris, General Manager Chris.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. You have a radio voice. That's fantastic. Yeah. And good morning, Chris, number two.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
You have a face for radio, they say.
I do.
Yeah. So that's what they tell me all the time. Well, welcome. And, you know, Hop Sports Grill is a sports bar out on in East Tucson. And tell us a little bit, Isabel, just briefly about the story of how long Hops has been in business and where you're located.
Okay. We have been in business going on 8 years. We opened up in 2017, and our address is 120 South Houghton, Suite 174.
So the easiest way to say that is the southwest corner of Broadway and Houghton, kind of next to the theater there.
Yes.
Yeah, so people know where that theater is. And the McDonald's is on the corner.
Yes.
So that corner of the... And a wonderful thing. Chris, General Manager Chris, you have a kind of a nice layout there. You walk in the front, you got a bar, and then seating on both sides, and then you also have an outside patio, right?
Yes, sir. It's pretty accommodating for most people.
Right.
Not so much like right now when it's 115 degrees out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is, it's can accommodate. How many people can be in if you have both sides filled up? Probably 100 or two?
130
or something like that.
120, 130.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite a big facility, and it's right there. It's also one of the facilities, when you think about it, east of, say, Kolb. There's not a lot on the east side. There's a couple of major bars and restaurants and sports facilities, but you're like one of, say, 10, I'm just going to guess, because I live out that way. I'm just going to say you're about one of 10 that are of that type. So it's a good service that you're providing to east side Tucsonans. And, well, let's talk a little bit about winning a couple of awards. And at least I was just there Saturday about a week ago with my brother Bill. We stopped in after going to Sonoyta Vineyards. And up on the wall, you got a couple of banners that say, you know, the 2023 one is best burger, best sports grill, best owner, best general manager, best kitchen manager and cook. it's pretty. And then in 2024 it comes again. So that's the reader's poll from the Arizona Daily Star. So Chris, tell me a little bit about what it's like working at a place that readers and patrons think is a pretty cool place.
Oh, it's fantastic, man. The great people of Tucson go in there. They always bring smiles to all of our employees and our kitchen staff. And
it's kind of like Cheers when I go in there. Everybody knows everybody. It's very friendly.
Yes, very much so.
And I'm usually there. One of my helpers on my team lives right across the wall from you there, so she likes to meet me there for meetings and stuff. And what an accommodating group there is. It's a friendly atmosphere. And then I was there on Saturday, as I said, and there was a gentleman who's one of your probably a regular. He was even cleaning a couple of plates off the bar and walking them back to the guy in the kitchen and so forth. So it's kind of a homey place, right?
Most definitely, yeah. We've been very fortunate with our customers there. They're always seeming to want to try to help us out.
And, right.
They want to see us succeed.
Be successful.
Also.
Yeah. Be successful. That's part of the reason that you probably got a lot of votes. Is they're really your customers are really wanting. So what's it like? I've known you from the hospitality industry for many years, but here you have taken on the reins of running a major facility on the east side. It's crazy, isn't it?
Very much so.
It never ends.
It never ends.
Yeah.
Never ends.
I mean, you wake up thinking about it, and you go to bed thinking about it, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. 24/7.
And then you're there all the time too. You know, I see you there frequently, and he's there all the time, but I see you there sometimes. Let's just say sometimes. Not
I'm
every
there
day.
All the time.
Yeah. But it is crazy. It's in the hospitality business. That's one of the things that it's a benefit, but a curse. The benefit is you get to interact with so many different people, but it also is a curse as well, in the sense that it just never ends, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Christmas Day, are you open Christmas Day? I mean,
no, so sir.
There's like 2 days a year that you close?
No. We close every major holiday.
Okay.
When we first opened the business, it was very important for us for, I call my staff my extended family.
Right.
And it's been very important for me to give them those days off to spend with their families.
Right, right.
Because family comes first.
Yeah, that's really important, mm-hmm. I think, especially in a setting like that where they're all working on trying to row in the same direction and so forth. So getting these People's Choice Awards, these Reader's Choice Awards, Best Sports Bar, Best Burger, those kinds of things. By the way, you do have a phenomenal burger. That's what I had last Saturday.
And thank you.
How do you get that? I mean, are you out campaigning for that, or is that just kind of organic? And people are they voting for you, or do you have some rabble rousers that are saying, "Let's vote for"?
No, that's strictly
organic,
our customers.
Yeah. I think that goes back, Isabel, to the fact that you're one of the major restaurants on the east side, because there's again a limited number of people places that people can go out there. It's kind of nice that you have that big facility that they can come mm-hmm. to and be, especially in that area. There's really nothing further east,
right?
And so you're kind of at the end of the road there, so
right.
Lots of people come to your facility.
Yes. And we, you know, we stay open fairly late, later mm-hmm. than any other businesses out there, I believe.
Right.
So that's a benefit for us also.
I'm kind of a Diamondbacks fan. Been a tough couple of weeks lately for the Diamondbacks, but I was out there Saturday, as I said, and they pulled up the game and we're watching the game on the TV. And that's kind of a nice thing about being a sports bar. There's just 18 million different kinds of sports that people were watching. I don't know, how many TVs do you have?
23.
25, I think.
25 TVs. And yeah. So sports is, you're wearing a, I don't know what that jersey is. I'm sure that's a University of Arizona jersey.
It's a horrible jersey.
I know. I'm the same. I'm with you, Chris. Chris is wearing his Kansas City Chiefs uniform.
It's best team in the league right now.
There
sorry.
You go. And probably the best quarterback in a long time. But sports is really important for the fans that come in and want to watch their sports teams, whether it be on NFL Sunday or whether it be Arizona Wildcats, football, basketball, baseball. It's kind of a neat atmosphere, isn't it?
Oh, yes, very much so. The competitiveness between our customers, too, it goes a long way. So they always give me stuff for everything that I wear on sports days and stuff
right.
like that. And I'm a real clown when it comes to the season. So that works
good.
Out good.
And then when the Chiefs are playing on Sunday, it's a big deal. And you're probably in that uniform. And
Actually, I'm in a much different uniform. But, yes,
yeah.
I am in all Chiefs stuff. Yeah. So
what about entertainment, Chris? Is there some entertainment that you have out there under the tent from time to time?
At the moment,
it's 117 degrees,
yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not the time. But
we do have somebody every first and third
Fridays. Is that Fridays?
Tuesdays
and Saturdays. Mm-hmm.
And then the second and fourth Saturday,
right?
And that'd be a Kiko de Gallo,
right? And that's Pico de Gallo. That's a little play on words.
Yeah.
Kiko de Gallo, I get that. But that's out under the tent, right?
And, yes.
And
yes.
So during the summer, it's a little toasty out there sometimes, so mm-hmm. it's not as easy to have. But you know, when the sun goes down and it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock,
and we do have
a pretty
decent cooler out there.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah, I was there again on Saturday, and it was Saturday afternoon, and big group of people who were there, they all went out there and sat out, and even though it was 100 degrees outside, they were still sitting out there having a great time. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful place. So you went from hospitality, from hotels and being a catering and sales manager, and to being a hospitality where you're dealing with the customers with food and beverages and so forth. What's the similarity of those, and what's the difference in that type of hospitality?
Meeting people, different people every day.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, you know, even our we have a lot of regular customers, and they've also become our extended family.
Right.
But having the catering experience from mm-hmm. the past has helped me run the restaurant.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of similarities with that. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy it every day. Every yeah. day, you know, seeing people come in and smiling. And also, we do allow children to be
right.
in there also. So
yeah, on Saturday, I saw mm-hmm. quite a few kids that were in there
yep.
with their folks and getting their last meal in before school started, kind of a thing, going out school shopping and so forth. So you also Chris, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the 8 million beers that you have on tap there. You have one whole full wall of taps. How many taps are there? How many handles?
39 handles.
39 handles. Well, that's a lot of beer. And and you have some local ones, but you also have, obviously, the national ones as well. So
most definitely.
What's a favorite local beer that people, I'm going to say Barrio Blonde, but that's just me. But
So Barrio Blonde is pretty popular as far as local.
Right.
I think Dragoon IPA is a little bit more popular than the Blonde.
Right. Around the wall there, where most of those other taps are, they get used on a regular basis, don't they?
Most definitely. There's one of the taps that are on the side there is a Imperial IPA that is very popular with the customers.
Right. Right. I just want you to know that I was there Saturday. I sampled every single one of them just to make sure that your beer was fresh and that everything was wonderful. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we'll talk a little bit about what you have to eat and what you have to offer there, and then how people can come see you and enjoy it. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and this is KVOI, where we talk to people on Friday during The Morning Voice that are doing great work in our community, who have success stories, if you will. Our guests today are Isabel Luceri, Chris Amador, and Chris Davenport of Hop Sports Grill. Good morning again, Isabel.
Good morning.
Again, you're located at East Side on Houghton and kind of the north, or excuse me, the southwest corner of Broadway and Houghton there, in that where the theater is and the McDonald's is. That's a pretty nice location, isn't it?
Very nice.
You've got a great parking lot there, and you have plenty of parking and easy to get to. And if someone wants a place to go to get some great food, that's a good place to go. So let's talk a little bit about the food you have to offer. Of course, I had the burger the other day. It was outstanding, by the way. I got it because it said right on the wall, the best burger in Tucson. So what are some of the featured dishes that you have there that you're really proud of?
Definitely would be our whiskey burger. It's a very popular item.
My brother had that. He really enjoyed it.
Yeah, everybody loves our whiskey sauce.
Just a little messy.
Yeah, but a messy burger is a good burger.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Our Philly cheesesteaks also are very good. Mm-hmm. And also whatever specials we're running at that point in time.
It seems
too.
Like almost every day, it seems like every couple of days you have another special, and those specials are, do you get to concoct those specials, or who gets to come up with the specials?
I think we all do, actually. We all sit down and come up with any type of ideas, brainstorming, and just find out which ones would be the best one for,
right?
Especially depending on the type of year, too.
Right, right. If it's hot like it is, you get a little bit more finger-friendly food, a little lighter fare.
Yeah.
And then when it's colder, it's all get out, maybe a little heavier and a little more dish. So,
well, this past Wednesday, we just started the prime rib special.
Oh, right. Yeah, I saw that coming up. So yeah.
That's always been a pretty popular dish when we have
it. What does that come with? It comes with prime rib. What are the sides?
Prime rib, mashed potatoes, garlic mashed potatoes. Mm-hmm. I believe we're going to do broccoli with it this time.
Yeah.
We did broccoli.
Right.
And a salad.
And a salad.
Yeah.
And what's the price point on that? About $20?
No, a 10-ounce piece is right around
30,
and then a 16-ounce piece is 35-ish.
35. Okay, great. But that gets you everything. It comes
all
with everything.
That, yep.
Yeah, that's great. Well, if somebody wanted to do something fun and wanted to go have a Friday, a Saturday, Sunday out at the Sports Grill, what are some of the traditions that someone would see if they came into Hops? First off, when you walk through, I'll just tell you there's a lot of energy in the place. The second you walk through the doors, you can tell there's some energy. But what are some of the fun things you do at Hops over the years? Is there anything fun? Do you have any tournaments or anything? Do you do anything, any pools for the Super Bowl or anything like that you do?
Yeah, we do. We do some pools for the Super Bowl. Well, actually, it's not really us. It's our customers are doing it, right?
Yeah.
But there's always somebody in there running some kind of
having fun,
a little pool, yeah,
doing some fun things about who's going to be in the Super Bowl and who the best quarterback in the country is, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's great. You said, Chris, that for the menu items that you kind of work as a team to come up with things. Is there anything new on the horizon for for hops that we should be aware of, or anything coming down the line that Prime Rib talked about, but is there anything else coming down that would be fun?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be a permanent item, but we have been doing Rubens lately.
Oh.
Those have actually been killing it pretty well.
Yeah, that sounds delicious, yeah.
And I make a pretty mean potato salad, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's
it's
good.
Delicious.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go down and have some of that. You know, one of the things, I'm just speaking as a customer. I ordered the burger on last Saturday, a week ago, and... holy smokes, the size of it and the amount of, I can see why you got that award for
half-pound burger. Mm-hmm.
It is huge, and it is, matter of fact, and I cut it in half and took half home with me because it was so big. And so I think if you have a good value for the money and the fun, it's delicious, and the beer and all the other stuff is cool too. So where can people find you? What's your hours, website, those kind of things, social media? Or just stop by. I mean,
just come by. You won't be disappointed.
Yeah, yeah.
We are open 7 days a week, 11 to 10, mainly during the week, and weekends we're open till 2 a.m.
The kitchen's open till 10 o'clock Sunday through Thursday, and then the bar usually stays open till around midnight.
Right.
And then Friday, Saturday, the kitchen's open till 11:30, 12, and then the bar open till 2.
That's another important thing. There's not a lot of places you can go to eat on the east side late at night. There's
correct.
Like there's no places to go. I mean, other than fast food, there's really no big restaurants that are open, again, east of maybe Kolb or that area. Unless you go maybe a little further north. And so it's nice to have a kitchen open late, especially if you're coming back from an event downtown or something and you want to pick up something on your way home. That's a good place. Well, one of the things we do here is we talk about success. And, you know, Isabel, you had a great run as a hospitality sales manager at local hotels and did a great job there. And but then you and your husband took on this challenge of running Hops Sports Grill, and it's been a pretty exciting thing. So we call this part of the program success. And how do you define success?
Yeah.
Looking around at the family that you have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, the door is still open, right?
The door is still open.
And it's amazing. I don't know if you're like other restaurateurs and entrepreneurs that payroll comes every 2 weeks, whether you want it or not, right?
Too fast.
Yeah. And the money's always there, right? It's thank God.
Thank God it's always there.
Yeah.
Been very fortunate on that.
Yep.
Yeah. And so success can be just stick-to-itiveness and just being part of an operation that tends to be exciting and fun. And it's, you don't dread going to work there. You actually are happy to go to work. Right?
It's my happy place.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless Chris hits you with something hit the door,
exactly.
Right? 32 of our 37 handles are down. But other than that, things are going great. So Chris, tell me one thing in your life. You've worked at a couple of places, and now you've been at Hops for a couple of years. Why do you still work there? Why are you still an employee at Hops, and why are you a manager and back in the kitchen and making potato salad and doing all the things? Why you stay there? Why don't you go do something else? What is it about Hops that keeps you coming back?
I just love it there. I love the people I work with. My bosses are fantastic. The people we work with are fantastic. The customers always keep me coming back.
They're amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, I've been there for about 7 years now,
right.
So I've been doing kitchen work for quite a bit, about 20 years or so, if not longer.
Right.
So, and I just love to cook. Love seeing the smile on the face when someone bites into something that you work hard to make.
Right, right. That Reuben and that potato salad are sounding pretty good right now, I want you to know. What about you, Chris? You've been there, you said 8 years, I think you've been there?
Yep,
helped
build it.
Why do you keep coming back, and why are you investing so much time and effort and energy and love into the place?
Well, Brian was kind of like a brother from another mother.
Right.
So that's part of it.
When you guys had this idea to start this up, he kind of grabbed you and said, "Hey, come on over.
Yeah.
Let's go do this.
Give me a hand with this." So
now you're handcuffed to the place.
Yeah,
now you can't leave.
Doubt.
No,
he's stuck with me.
Yeah. Locked down.
Yeah. I think one of the best things about it is like it's close to home.
Yeah,
you know,
your son was in there the other day, a couple of weeks ago. I saw him.
My little giant.
Yeah, he's about 6'3" or something like that. Yeah.
Almost 5'10" for 12 years old.
Yeah, he's going to be a big guy. What was interesting when I walked into the studio, when you guys walked into the studio, you'd all come together, but you'd come separately. Hugs, hugs, hugs.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that much, to be honest with you. I thought that for an owner to be hugging her general manager and her manager of the kitchen, that's that says something about what you do there, Isabel, and the tribute to Brian and what he brought to the table early on. So it's kind of great. So what's the future look like for Hops? You're just going to keep doing good things and kind of keep it the same, but move forward as fast as you can. And keep serving people in the East Texas zone.
Just keep doing what we're doing. You know, embrace everybody with a hug and a smile and make them feel like they're at home.
Right. Well, I'm one of your good customers, and I will say that Danya was the one that got me started going there because, again, her house is just across the wall there. And
thank you, Danya.
She's a sweetheart, and I have to tell you, the food is delicious, the beer is cold, and the service is friendly, and I honestly only go to places where I feel like I'm welcome and comfortable, and so I appreciate what you guys do. And at least when I walk in, I feel like I'm very welcome there. And that's and even from the customers, a couple of your customers have come up and talked to me and said they kind of recognized who I was and had nice conversations with a couple of them. So
a lot of the customers think they work there sometimes.
Definitely.
Well, great. Hop Sports Grill. If you haven't voted yet, vote for the Reader's Choice Awards. It's currently underway. This is Friday, so tonight go out. If you haven't got anything, any plans, go out Friday to see Isabel Luceri, Chris Amadori, and Chris Davenport of Hop Sports Grill. A great facility on the east side of Tucson. Isabel, it's great to reconnect with you after all these years being in the same domicile for so many years. I was there 18 years too, so
yes, sir.
So it's great to have you back in my life, as
they
say.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Likewise.
I appreciate what you guys, Chris and Chris, have done to make us all feel welcome at Hop Sports Grill. So, Matt, we're going to have to get over there and have some burgers and some beer, aren't we?
You don't have to ask me twice. Now I'm thirsty. I'm thirsty for a beer and hungry for a burger. So I love Hop Sports Grill. Okay. I'm an East Side guy. Great place.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, thank you all for being here today, and we appreciate you so much, and we'll be out to see you at Hop Sports Grill.
Definitely appreciate you also.
This is The Morning Voice on KVOI, and Matt, we'll have another guest. We'll talk a little bit about another success story, and then in the second hour, we'll be talking about Wonder at the University of Arizona. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice on this Friday morning. Matt, we got to go out to Hops and have a beer and a burger. And it just got me going this morning here.
Yeah, so, sounds good.
Yeah. Those are nice people, and they have a nice facility. Hey, on Friday mornings, we do Success the first hour. We do Wonder at the University of Arizona the second hour. And so our second guest for Success this morning is Matt August, who is the Kasser Family Artistic Director at the Arizona Theater Company. Good morning and welcome, Matt.
Good morning. How are you?
Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I do have a question for you. Matt, we got a reverb. Okay, thanks. You grew up in your role as artistic director, doing some acclaimed productions. How have what doing that as artistic director and growing into that role, how has that those past experiences shaped your leadership now at ATC?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. You know, I've been fortunate to work all over the country. I've worked on Broadway. I worked in regional theaters. And, you know, every experience that I've had, and I've been very fortunate to sit on the shoulders of some wonderful, wonderful artistic directors at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, at the Huntington in Boston, and particularly at the Old Globe, where I was working with Jack O'Brien for a long time. And it just reinforced how vital storytelling is vital to building community. You know, for several years when I worked with Jack O'Brien as his assistant and his associate director, with, you know, no pun intended, he is really a jack of all trades. You know, so I listened to him deeply, you know, both to the text and to the people in the room. And, you know, as an artistic director, I apply those same principles across the organization, listening to our artists, our staff, and our audience, and the broader Arizona communities, to make the choices that resonate widely, so that but that also, you know, challenges to grow.
So you have most of your staff is here in Tucson. What initially drew you into the ATC, the Arizona Theater Company community, and what got you to kind of come here and say, okay, Tucson's the place I want to grow my craft?
Yeah. Well, you know, ATC is really, you know, for a long time, widely considered to be one of the great, you know, institutional theaters in the country, the one of the great regional theaters. So it was always on my radar as a place to produce great work that had integrity and ambition and, you know, really smart audiences and high entertainment value. I first came here as a freelance director. I directed a play with the longest title in the history of theater, the Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. And then I was immediately asked back to direct King Charles III, and that was the regional premiere of that show. And you know, when I got here, I was really struck by the level of professionalism and the severity the artists took their work. You know, I was also very impressed with how passionate and deeply engaged the audiences were, both in Tucson and up in the Phoenix metro area. Mm-hmm. And since stepping into this leadership role, you know, that connection has deepened. There's a genuine hunger for meaningful, high quality theater in Arizona that is capable of transferring into New York and looks very, you know, top shelf and challenges audiences and really entertains them. So it's a privilege to be the person who gets to feed that appetite.
And your season is described, as you just mentioned, the professionalism and so forth of your staff and of your presentation teams and so forth. Your season is described as, quote, adventurous, mystery-filled, packed with humor, friendship, and fun, unquote. What does that mean to you as the leader in practical terms of what kind of presentations you're giving to audiences both here and in Phoenix?
Yeah. You know, it means that we've got a season that we've built to entertain people while offering them something much more, you know, so that they have a real intellectual experience and they have a real emotional experience. Every production in our lineup engages with curiosity and surprise and really tries to connect us as human beings with each other. You know, whether it's a psychological thriller like Deceived or a laugh out loud caper like Dracula, or Heist, you know, or a heartfelt connection celebration of music like Ain't Misbehaving. You know, I wanted to ensure that every show has a journey for the audiences, something that lingers after the curtain will fall.
That's great. You know, I'm kind of a traditionalist. I like to go to the shows that are, you know, kind of have longstanding and are kind of new iterations of you know, as a, probably my wife would say the same old thing. But there's a lot of new stuff out there. And, you know, I reluctantly go. But when I go, I am pleasantly pleased. And so the mix of old traditional theater and then coming up with some of the new stuff is kind of a nice thing to have, especially for you know, audiences, members like me who kind of are stuck in the mud, I guess I am. So that balance that you get between brand new works and classics, that's an important thing to do for the audience, right?
Yeah, you know, when we put the season together, we think about, you know, first of all, what messages we want to convey to the community that we serve. Mm-hmm. And then we also look closely at how the audience has responded to the previous season and previous seasons before that. You know, we really ask ourselves what shows resonated, you know, what shows sparked conversations, what shows felt meaningful, what shows were really dazzling and you know, had a very high entertainment value. And, you know, this season is very much informed by that response. You know, we did a deep dive into it and came up with these five titles. Right. We had great success last season, and we wanted to lean into that momentum while continuing to evolve artistically as an organization.
So let's talk a little bit about a couple of those shows. Deceived is the season opener. That's a modern kind of a adaptation of a thriller. Tell us a little bit about Deceived and what audiences can expect when they see Deceived.
Yeah, so Deceived is a reimagining of the play Gaslight. It's an adaptation of it. You know, Gaslight, the classic psychological thriller that gave us the very term gaslighting. And what drew me to this adaptation was that it preserves the tension and the suspense and the mystery, while it also reframes the narrative in a way that feels urgently modern. Certain characters are given way more agency, and that shift adds a deeper complexity and emotional charge to the story. It becomes less about, you know, one woman being driven mad as it is in the film, and more about her resilience, her clarity, and the strength that she finds to reclaim her own reality when someone else is trying to distort it. So, you know, these themes of control and perception and autonomy, you know, those are as relevant today as they ever were. You know, so Deceived resonates. It's going to resonate because it sparks into the power dynamics that we continue to navigate in relationships and institutions and even in the media. So it's a very immediate story right now.
You're listening to The Morning Voice, and our guest is Matt August, the Kassar Family Artistic Director at Arizona Theater Company. You have the U.S. premiere of Heist coming as well. Tell us a little bit about Heist.
Oh, Heist is a real fun play. It's sort of an Ocean's 11 style caper, you know, mystery. You know, it's a heist play, and there are several you know, physical and technical feats that we get to conquer and that are really going to challenge us with this show, both, you know, production wise and institutionally, but also for the audience. There's literally a ton of moving parts in this show. But it's pure theater joy because it's witty, it's fast paced, it's wildly inventive. And, you know, bringing this caper to life on stage is a real challenge because you can't rely on the camera the way that you do, on film. And we're going to have to find a lot of very technical solutions to those challenges. We get to be very playful and ingenious with how we're going to use the stage and the ensemble and the audience's imagination, you know, and it's a great reminder that live theater can be just as pulse pounding and propelling as the movies can be, if not more.
Let's do one more, Ain't Misbehaving, one that I will probably be seeing because since I'm stuck in the mud, as they say. Tell us about the musical review of Ain't Misbehaving.
Oh, this show is pure soul and swing, and it just radiates joy. You know, amid our season of twists and turns and reinventions, Ain't Misbehaving is a celebratory pause. You know, it's a tribute to Black artistry, the resilience, rhythm, and the music. You know, the music that came out of that Harlem Renaissance of Fats Waller. Its energy uplifts the entire season. It's going to uplift the entire season and remind us that fun is just as important as theater in theater as drama is. And the director is going to give us a totally new take on Ain't Misbehaving. It's something that he describes as a burlesque circus. So I cannot wait to see what he comes up with for this.
That's great. We'll take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about community and institutional roles of ATC. We'll talk a little bit about the leadership and organizational structure that you have, and maybe from your perspective, the creative and future thinking on how you put together the shows that are going to get audiences to want to come and come again and come again. And we want to shout out to Beth and Mike Kassar for their great support of the Arizona Theater Company over the years. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Our guest is Matt August, the Kassar Family Artistic Director at Arizona Theater Company. This is KVOI, 1030 AM, Tucson's live local talk radio, and you are listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is Friday morning, so this is where we talk about success and talk about organizations and groups that are doing good work in our city and highlighting the people that are behind that. Our guest this morning is Matt August. He is an appropriate name for an August interview. Matt August is the Kassar Family Artistic Director at the Arizona Theater Company. They have an upcoming season coming. Welcome back again, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about ATC. You know, I gave a shout out to Mike and Beth for their support of ATC, but, you know, it's had its ups and downs over the 58 years, and it's in one of those positive trajectories right now with lots of good things going on. But ATC has long positioned itself as a civic cultural institution and community convener. In what ways does this season, you kind of talked about a little bit, but how does this extend that role for Arizonans both here and up in Phoenix?
Yeah. You know, every show this season is designed to spark conversations, you know, about relationships, about truth, about resilience, and the roles that we play in our universe. They're also, you know, built to delight and inspire and you know, tickle audiences. But what we really want to do is continue to build bridges, you know, into the community for dialogue and have talkbacks and build partnerships with local organizations. We're trying to get more engagement programming that brings people into the creative process, you know, so that they don't just see what's about on stage. It's about how theater lives beyond the stage, you know, going into classrooms, into living rooms and community centers. So we're trying to really get out there into the community quite a bit more.
Like all organizations, you might know my brother. He just left the Tucson Arizona Boys Chorus after 45 years as the director. And all organizations, you know, the Boys Chorus is 80 years old, and ATC is 58 years old, and all organizations over that period of time have leadership come and go, and executive directors come and go, directors and producers come and go, obviously artists and actors come and go, and production staff. And so there's a constant transition in a huge organization like ATC. With that, how do you ensure that the continuity and the momentum or the flame is kept alive in ATC as you move into the future?
Yeah, great question. You know, Jerry Wright, our former executive director, took us through COVID. She built an incredible organization that internally was as stable as ATC has ever been. She you know, helped build an incredible board of directors. She built a very solid framework inside the institution. And when she decided to, you know, leave us earlier this year, she left a very strong organization for us to take to another level. You know, we've been very intentional about building very strong, very collaborative leadership team that aligns with our core mission. And while transitions are challenging, yeah, they are also opportunities to refine the organization and to refocus the organization and to grow the organization. And, you know, our hope is that, you know, we take this moment to really kind of break out of a chrysalis that we've been in and really fly and have our potential be reached as, you know, as gloriously and as quickly as we possibly can. You know, and as the result of all of that internal growth that we've had over the last couple of years, our teams haven't missed a beat during this transitionary period. And you're going to, and audiences will totally see that on stage. And I've made it my own personal priority to maintain a clear vision with constant communication with the organization's leadership, both internally and externally, so that we can keep moving forward with purpose and with energy and with clarity.
And that dovetails right into the Rise Above campaign. As all arts organizations, you rely heavily, if not 100%. Ticket sales are important, but most of what you get is donations and philanthropic giving and a little bit of government funding like National Endowment of the Arts sometimes and so forth. But with national budgets being cut, state budgets being cut, you rely a lot on the donor to give support. So tell us a little bit about the impact of donor relations and having people come and support ATC in our community.
Yeah, you know, we could not do this without our supporters in the community. You know, Mike and Beth obviously being at the vanguard of that charge. You know, you mentioned the NEA and government really cutting back on funding for the arts. And that is a very real reality. You know, what we are we just had an NEA grant canceled for a program that we've been doing for 26 years. This is our 27th year doing the program, and now we are struggling to come in with funding that's going to supplement what they took away. But the support from the community is really where it's at. It's, you know, theater is a very grassroots endeavor, and it is driven, you know, probably about 45% by ticket sales and then 55% by philanthropic donations. And, you know, Arizona Theater Company has a full-time staff of about 74. We bring in over 120 artists every season from both locally in Arizona and around the country. And that creates a very big overhead for the organization. And to really sustain it, we do need the community support. So yeah, the Rise Above campaign has been designed to help us, you know, to fill in what are the philanthropic needs are year to year, but then to rise above that nut so that we can continue to grow and build our programming on stage so that it says and our reach into the community so that it is as impactful and as top shelf as we can possibly make it.
Fantastic. Where can people go to buy tickets and to get involved and maybe give a little shout out to ATC from their checkbook? Where can they go to learn more about ATC?
Yes, that's great. It's a very simple website. It's atc.org.
Okay, that's pretty simple. Give me a simple answer on this one, too. This show is called Success. What's your definition of success?
Oh, success to me, it means that when our work entertains differently than any other form, it sparks dialogue, it deepens people's empathy and it brings people together, you know, so that it's not just about ticket sales or reviews. It's about the joy and the conversations in the lobby after the show. It's the moments of recognition between strangers who might be very different, but after spending an hour and a half, 2 hours alone in the dark, listening to a story that we've shared with them, that they feel both inspired and brought together and connected. And, you know, that's the theater that magic really can provide, that no other medium can, as a way to engage the imagination, to tap into our hearts and our philosophies and our minds and make people feel just better about being part of a community than they did when they walked in the theater.
That sounds really successful. Thanks to Matt August, Castor Family Artistic Director at Arizona Theater Company. We'll be back after the break with Wonder from the University of Arizona. This is KVOI 1030 AM, Tucson's live local talk, and you're listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome to The Morning Voice on this wonderful Friday, 108 degrees, 106 degrees today in this balmy Friday morning in the summer in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona. This all came about when I ran for mayor. People would go to an event, I'd get pinned to the wall. People want to tell me all the things that are wrong with government and crime and roads and parks and all the things, and they'd let them go on for 5 or 6 minutes, and then I'd look at them and say, why do you stay? Why don't you just leave? And they'd look at me and say, oh, we love the University of Arizona. We love the weather. We love the mountains. We love, our kids grew up here. We're sixth generation. It's the greatest place in the world. Well, this show is about the second half of that conversation I had with those constituents. The first half, lots of other people talk about the negative things going on in Tucson. I like to talk about the good things going on, especially at the University of Arizona. And we call this Wonder, and it's sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit. They're our big sponsor. I should probably get that right, Matt?
Hughes Federal Credit Union.
I should probably
say
get that
right. Say it in your sleep, sir.
I do.
Caruso's and Hughes Federal Credit Union.
I say that in my sleep, yeah. Thank you.
You can have something to eat and use the debit card to pay for it. So.
I love it.
There you
hey,
go.
Hey, tell us about being live on Facebook.
We're on, for U of A Wonder Stories today, we're streaming on Facebook and YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the Facebook page, and 1030 The Voice is the YouTube channel. Like and subscribe. And keep in touch with us.
Thank you very much.
You can see your voice, Ed.
There you go.
It'll be a million degrees out, but you can see your voice.
I love it. Well, welcome, Chris Bazin. He is a research specialist, senior, College of Science in the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Ed.
Thank you for being here today. So, when we get started, just tell us a little bit. We've had one or two people in about the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, but tell us a little bit about what you do there and when you got interested in driftwood from the cave in the Grand Canyon. So tell us a little bit about, you've been with the U of A a long time, almost 40 years, right?
Yeah, I have a degree in forestry, actually, from the university. So I was interested in forest ecology initially,
right.
But I've worked a lot with the wood collection that the mm-hmm. laboratory houses there. We got samples that we've collected over the last century, really mm-hmm. stored in the archive. And we had to move from the
football stadium
yeah. to the new building.
Yeah. That was quite an undertaking, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2013. And so I became familiar with all of the material that we had stored there. We had to actually physically move it and rehouse it. So,
and speaking of the new place, we'll talk about this a little bit more maybe, but there is a new facility, and you and I were talking about this the other day, and you encouraged me personally to come down and visit. And so as we talk about what we're going to be talking about here in the Grand Canyon and some driftwood and so forth, let's talk just a little bit briefly about, as we launch into this discussion of what trees can tell us and what their historical record is. People can go see the tree research lab on a pretty regular basis. They go almost every day. There's something they can do.
So the lobby is open 8 to 5 during the work week, mm-hmm. and visitors are welcome to come in. We have some exhibits there and kind of a self-tour with QR code for the phone and things.
But so you aim your phone and it tells you what's going on, kind of like a museum kind of a thing, yeah.
And there's also docent tours led mm-hmm. by, we have a set of docents that take people around, and you can sign up for those and come and get a more extensive tour.
I highly encourage that, because the Tree Ring Lab Research facility is world famous, and it is one of the largest in the world, and it has given us some incredible
things.
It's the first one, yeah. And you know, again, going to back to what I said earlier about why we do wonder. I often say that people drive down Speedway in Campbell and they look over and see those red brick buildings, but they have no idea what's going on down there. And if you've lived in Tucson for any the length of time and you haven't been to the Tree Ring Lab, you got to go take a look at it because it just is amazing what can be done there. So let's talk a little bit about when you first realized that there might be a connect, after you moved all that stuff and you kind of said, okay, we got something going on here, that there might be a connection between meteor crater impact and the driftwood found high up in Stanton's Cave in the Grand Canyon.
So we had a visitor from New Zealand who works at a radiocarbon facility down there. He was visiting for some other purpose, and they had been investigating some wood in that was found in New Zealand that was about 42,000 years old, giant log, and it lived during a time when there was a partial polar reversal, so the magnetic field shifted on the Earth. And this changed the radiocarbon signal in the atmosphere. And so they had been studying this. And I had understood that the driftwood that came from Stanton Cave in Arizona had been radiocarbon dated to approximately the same time. And so I just talked with this fellow. I said, you know, hey, maybe we could check that, because if it actually is at the reversal, then maybe it would be interesting to know that. Right. And we could do something with it.
Right.
And so... He agreed and took the wood back to New Zealand. They ran the date, and it came back at 50,000 years, not the 42, or a little more than 50,000. And he had actually visited Meteor Crater, and he said, you know, what else happened at 50,000 years ago is the meteor strike. And so there was a group of people already involved in this, and we began kicking this around and saying, huh, that's kind of interesting, maybe. Right. We should look into that and see if there's possibly a real connection.
So one of the things you were looking at is the possibility of this meteor coming in and striking the famous crater in Arizona, that shock might have triggered a landslide in the Grand Canyon, right?
That's correct. So the people that did some research in the 1960s and 70s at the Stanton Cave, it's actually an archaeological site, so they had been interested in various things there. But they dug some trenches, and at the bottom of their trenches was a bunch of driftwood. And the cave, the mouth of the cave, is over 100 feet above the river. They really wanted to come up with an idea about, well, how does
it so high up and the water's way down there?
Flood or what?
Yeah.
And so their investigation suggested that there had been a rock fall. Maybe 20 miles down the river that had where the side of the canyon had fallen across the river and dammed it and made a giant lake, and this had raised the water level and then allowed the driftwood to come into the cave. So
and the thought is that lake was maybe 300 feet deep and maybe as long as 50 miles backed up.
That's correct.
On the river, and so that's how the driftwood got into the
and
cave.
And so it's unusual to have. A rockfall dam, you know, that makes
holds,
a lake of
that holds,
size.
With that much pressure on
so
it.
So the fact that that's a really unusual event, and the fact that the meteor was perhaps coincident, and they're not that far apart, so a little over 100 miles. So we thought, well, maybe there might be a connection that the impact had actually shaken the rocks loose and caused the dam.
So was it the driftwood itself that gave you the dating of 50,000, 56,000 years?
Yes, that's correct.
So being able to look at the Tree Ring Lab research that you've done over the last 100 years, that was the map that gave you the clock that told you when this event might have happened 50,000 years ago.
Yeah, the original excavation around 1970, they had collected this driftwood and it was there, and so we had it and knew some information about it, and then we repurposed it
Tell us a little bit about how the I get that every year or every season there's another the tree grows, and so it gets a little bit of a skin on it, and then as that moves out, it the older a tree is, the more rings there are. It's just like anything, and that's kind of how you from a layman's perspective, how you can kind of see the age of a tree and when it was how long it lived and how long ago it lived, because you can read those rings, right?
Sure, but when we're talking 55,000,
it's a rock at that point. It's a rock, right? Yeah.
It's wood.
It's wood still.
It's still wood, and so this enables us to do a radiocarbon date, and the individual annual rings incorporate atmospheric carbon, and this has a radioactive carbon 14 component.
You can date it by that carbon then,
and
right?
We can tell how much is left after 50,000 years and get a date for it. So this is used for all kinds of things, not just tree rings, but the
tree rings, the lab, that's how you get the dating, is to read that carbon 14 date. Yeah, as part
in this case, yes. Yeah. I mean, so most of our work, we look at the annual rings, and
with
we
the
use
rings
pattern,
how you
we use pattern matching of the rings. So like for the last, you know, hundreds or some thousands, or in the case of the bristlecone pine, you know, 10, 12,000 years, we can use the ring pattern. But when you're talking about really ancient stuff, it's...
So the ring pattern itself is kind of like a thumbprint or a fingerprint.
That's correct.
It's unique, but it, if you had a bunch of trees that are all in the same area and they all kind of started at the same time and grew at the same time and then kind of died at the same time, they'd all have this similar ring pattern to them in that one area.
Yes, because of their similar growing environment.
Right, but if you went 100 miles away, it might be a little different, right?
Wet and dry periods or warm and cold.
Right. That's great. Well, this is a very interesting topic, and the tree ring, the laboratory at the Tree Ring Research Lab, is just a phenomenal place and a very unique and interesting way to look at the world. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about some sleuthing that you do with this scientific thing and what are next for your research and what things might be happening at the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research. We're talking with Chris Bazin. He's a research specialist in the College of Science, and this is Wonder, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona, and our guest is Chris Bazin, and we'll be back after a break on The Morning Voice. Welcome to Wonder, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Our guest is Chris Bazin, who is a research specialist from the College of Science in the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona. On Fridays, we talk about those good things, and Wonder is sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue and our good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. Well,
there you go.
I got it. Well, Chris, it sounds like the discovery of the driftwood in the 70s and then how you tied that into the landslide and the carbon dating of the wood and how the world was in 50 or 52,000 years ago. Those things take a lot of collaboration and some chance encounters. So every once in a while, you just kind of hit gold, right?
You're talking
to the right person at the right time, and all of a sudden you collaborate a little bit, and all of a sudden you see something that maybe you didn't see before.
Oh, we had a question, you know, about this magnetic reversal, and then when we got the date back, it was actually disappointing at first because it's like 10,000 years older. It doesn't have anything to do with that. And
so you were trying to kind of dovetail it into that 40,000 year ago event.
Yeah.
And darn, it didn't work.
Didn't,
it was 10,000 years before that. Yeah.
The John Palmer, who I'd given the wood to, he had been on a road trip and had visited Meteor Crater on his way down to see us at the Tree Ring Lab. And so he knew what the date was, and it's like, wow, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe there's something there to look into.
That's interesting.
That was
so you had this hypothesis then about what might have happened and how it happened and how the crater was created and how the meteor came in and disrupted the universe at that time, our universe anyways, not the universe, our universe here on Earth. What does that tell us about how meteor impacts in the future can affect landscapes far beyond their immediate crash into the ground and boom, they make a lot of dust and might change the weather a little bit for a little while, but and God forbid it's too big that it causes havoc for years on end. But if it's a size like the one that hit up at Crater Lake and so forth, what is the implication of that from what your hypothesis holds?
So the Earth impacts actually all the planetary bodies get hit by objects, you know, throughout their history, and Earth is no
millions,
exception.
Millions of years ago, we got hit every 15 seconds or whatever.
Yeah,
which is,
right.
They were coming at us.
Right.
And over the last
millennia. But they still come.
Yeah, they
and
still come.
So like in 2013, there was one that exploded in the air over Russia.
Right.
And the blast was about 500 kilotons. So the Nagasaki bomb was 20 kilotons.
Mm.
So that was an air blast, and it damaged things on the Earth, but it didn't actually hit the ground.
Right. But it damaged communication. It damaged lots of different things because of its explosion in the air.
The shockwave went around the world just from that.
Right.
And
right.
So, this one, so that one was 500 kiloton, 500,000 tons of TNT equivalent. Mm-hmm. So the Meteor Crater one is 10 megaton blast. That's the estimate.
So equate
so
that.
That's 10 million tons.
Wow, that's huge.
It's huge compared. Yeah. And the one that extinguished the dinosaurs was 100 million megatons.
Right. It's like another planet hitting us almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the rock that made the Arizona crater is maybe 100 feet in diameter. It was iron.
Right.
Very dense rock, mm-hmm. and it excavated a crater over 500 feet deep and actually broke the rock another 700 feet down into the Earth. So it's a huge impact,
right.
And it's the most recent well-preserved mm-hmm. crater of that type. It's something that, you know, 50,000 years, it seems like a long time to us, but geologically speaking, it's quite recent,
yeah.
And we know that these things still happen, and so studying the rate and the consequences of these things, has current value. And we know there's an asteroid search where they're trying to figure
right.
out, you know, are there objects that are going to come? And
yeah, we just had the Catalina Sky Survey was on last weekend, I think, yep. last week or the week before, where they were talking about, we don't need to worry right now.
Right.
We're not going to get hit anytime soon, but they never know when something might. And there are some times when they can't see some things
yeah.
until, but it's in the, they said the next decade or two, not to worry too much, next 100 years, they're not seeing anything out
there. Seeing anything,
but
space is big, and,
yeah.
And you know, you can things
travel fast in
they
space,
do, yeah.
yeah, yeah. And we can't even figure that out. Are there other sites, nearby lakes or sediment deposits that might hold evidence of this ancient event, or has this thing happened? Was there other places you might look for evidence of this?
So, there's actually a set of craters over by Odessa, Texas,
mm-hmm.
that we think might be related, might have been actually from the same original body, so it might have broken up into several pieces.
Right.
And so that's something that we'd like to look into, see that the current dating of that those craters in Texas is similar,
mm.
and the composition of the impactor was the same. So
a couple of meteors at the same time hitting at the same time. They break up in the atmosphere and come, that kind of a thing.
Or maybe before.
Right.
I mean,
a thousand years before.
Maybe the
or something.
Object was broken apart in space,
right.
and then the things traveled together and
for quite a distance, right.
Earth.
Right.
So those are important kinds of things. Both for the question about the meteor crater itself, but also in general.
Right. So, what are the next steps in your research? As you are you going to go back to Stanton's Cave? Are you going to explore other Grand Canyon alcoves? What's next step in this? You've been at the U of A for 40 years, and you get to look at these kind of things. What's next on your list?
So, as far as this particular question, my co-author Carl Carlstrom is making trips to the Grand Canyon to try to get more evidence about the lake and look at the Rockfall Dam, try to get a date for that to see if it all ties in and our hypothesis hangs together.
Mm-hmm.
David Kring, who's a meteor crater expert, wants to do some drilling there, take a new core, get a better sense of the date of the impact. Maybe we can.
Very cool.
Tie this together.
Very cool. Well, first off, I want to give you a gift certificate from one of our sponsors, Caruso's. Go down to 4th Avenue and take some of your U of A friends with you and have lunch on a Friday
And, well, thank you for that.
Call it a weekend. Hey, you're part of Wonder. This is called Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the university. What's one thing at the University of Arizona that you think is full of wonder?
Well, I just think the whole campus is just it's so diverse. It has, you know, the Lunar and Planetary People, Stewart Observatory. It has the planetarium there. Mm-hmm.
The tree lab,
the Mineral Museum. They've got arts and, you know, Center for Creative Photography. It's a great place for people who aren't necessarily directly connected with the university, but if you want to come and visit, bring the children or whatever.
Bring grandkids too. Yeah. They love
it. Yeah. When they grow up, they can go to school there. And,
exactly.
Study all kinds of things that might help them in their careers and help us as the population in general, just expand our horizons.
So. Great. If someone wanted to know how to go visit the Tree Ring Lab and the work that you do and learn a little bit more about your research and what you plan on doing in the future, where would they go to find out that information? Where do they find out about
there's
the lab?
So the Tree Ring Laboratory has a website.
You could type in Tree Ring Lab in your search engine, and it would get you right there.
For U of A, it would take you there.
It'd take you the first thing.
And the street address is 1215 East Lowell Street.
Okay. What's it kind of near, if you were a landmark? It's kind of in the middle of campus.
Well, the Sixth Street Garage.
Oh, that's right there.
The parking structure is right there, and we're just kitty-cornered to that.
Right.
It's a very nice place compared to, the football stadium where we used to be.
Although
the Mirror Lab is still over there, which is another
I saw that thing, last night. Yeah, it was after our conversation we had the other day. I was remembering that we had talked about the Mirror Lab being underneath the stadium, and when football games come, they got to be careful that the mirrors don't shake too much that they crack. So it's kind of amazing. Well, thank you so much. Special thanks to our guest for Wonder, Chris Bazin. He's a research specialist at the College of Science and the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, and he has great information about what happened in the Grand Canyon when that meteor struck. And so we appreciate you coming in today and sharing your insights with us. We'll be back after a break with the second half of Wonder with University of Arizona Senior Vice President Tomas Diaz de la Rubia, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant and Hughes Federal Credit Union. We're on KVOI, and you're listening to The Morning Voice.
Yeah, let's go to the Tree Ring Labs and then go over to Hops for lunch or Caruso's. And I think we got a few day trips. Morning Voice day trips for us. What do you say?
Nothing bad with day drinking, right?
That escalated quickly. Okay, if you insist.
It is Friday.
Yeah, yeah, come on.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Chris, for being here.
Okay, thank you, Ed.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is Friday morning where we talk about Wonder, the good things going on at the University of Arizona. I'm Dr. Ed Ackerley. I've had the rare privilege of being at the University of Arizona in the Eller College for about 35 years. Enjoy my time there and being able to instruct the young whippersnappers of our world and teach them about marketing and advertising. Our Wonder segment is sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. We're very honored today to have the Senior Vice President for Research and Partnerships at the University of Arizona, Tomas Diaz de la Rubia. Good morning.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. Tan tan. Orale, as they say. So, hey, thanks for coming today, and let's talk a little bit about your role as the Senior Vice President for Research and Partnerships. And obviously, the University of Arizona is a Research One institution, and it has a long history of providing tons of things that Americans, Arizonans, Tucsonans, and in fact, the world would benefit from the great research that's been done over the years at the University of Arizona. So what does it mean to be a billion-dollar research enterprise, and how does that benefit all this large community?
So, Ed, I just said, you know, the University of Arizona really has a phenomenal history, tradition, DNA of research, and impact on society through its research. Being a billion-dollar institution in research activity means that we're really among the best in the world. We really reflects the fact that it's not just the volume, but the impact, the scope of the research that we do that has tremendous benefits for society. There are very few. We're one of the top 20 public universities in the country that operate at $1 billion of research. We work across the federal government. We work with philanthropies, with private sector companies. with the state. And as I say, the work that we do really ultimately, the important thing about it is not sort of the billion, but it's the impact that we have on our communities, on the nation, on the world.
Right. And, you know, we don't want to get into the weeds here, and this isn't a political show per se, even though I ran for mayor. It's not a political show. But, you know, what are the university's strategic priorities? But also, as this effect of the trickle-down effect of research dollars maybe being pulled from some of the programs at the U of A, from federal grants and federal dollars that are being reallocated and all that happening, and the research community on our campus has to be nimble and has to be collaborative and kind of make do with what they have. What is the priority then, and where are you going to focus your work over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so it's really important to provide focus in what we do. We cannot just be all things to all people. The university has tremendous strengths in certain areas, and President Gary Mella, myself, the leadership team working across the campus, we've identified four new areas of focus that build, as I say, on our strengths. And you know, working with the Arizona Board of Regents, we've been able to launch some new initiatives, which I think are really exciting for the university. As you know, this university is second to none in the world when it comes to space, to astronomy, to the wonders of understanding, you know, what's the universe, how does it operate, what is our place in the universe. When you think about also the geopolitical context today, you know, space is a very contested area. Space is critical to our economy, our communications, everything that we do today as society.
Our security now.
Security.
Even. Yeah.
And so we looked at this, and we look at the convergence of space science and national security. And we think that this is a place that is really important for us as a university to be able to contribute to what it is that we need to do to secure our assets in space, to make sure that we as a society are protected in space, from where we do so many, many things today, from navigating in a car to everything else.
I like to tout on a regular basis, I say this as many times as people will listen to me, and that is every NASA space major mission since its creation has involved the University of Arizona, and with the U of A leading some of the most major ones. And that is, I don't think there's any other university in the world that can say that other than the U of A. So.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're building on that history, on that tradition, on that strength, and you know, we're going to take it to the next level, both on the civilian side, on the NASA discovery science side, as well as on the national security side.
So you talked about space and astronomy, and you had a couple of other innovations and things. What are some other things that you're working on?
Yeah, so we're also working on artificial intelligence. Right? We look at artificial intelligence like everybody, and there is no doubt that if artificial intelligence is used responsibly, ethically, in a transparent manner, it can have tremendous benefits to society across all spectrums of society, across all areas. We have decided that, you know, as we focus on how do we train our students, how do we prepare them for a future in which AI is going to be integral to how they work, what they do in their lives, that there is an area which is the future of health, how artificial intelligence is impacting our ability to provide better health outcomes for Arizonans, for Americans, for the world. And this is already underway. Is a revolution that is already underway, and we want to be really on the leading edge of that revolution as a university. We think that by bringing artificial intelligence, digital technologies, telemedicine together, we can provide better health outcomes for everybody, for rural communities, for indigenous communities, across the board. We can have a big, big impact on healthcare. How healthcare will be delivered is being delivered today, but will be delivered more so, ever more so in the future.
It's interesting that you talk about AI like that. That's a great collaboration between a bunch of different colleges and departments and so forth. You know, I'm over at the Eller College, and I'm old enough to have been there long enough. We remember when Facebook and the digital space came in, and we had to readjust our teaching in order to incorporate this, and obviously the textbooks were all changed and so forth. We don't even have textbooks anymore. We have AI generated thing from the publishers that is, it's called Evergreen. It comes out, it's up to date, it's up to the second, up to the minute, and there's no such thing as backpacks with books in them anymore. But one of the directives we got this particular semester was You got to incorporate the AI into how it's affecting advertising and marketing, and you got to really focus on that. So here I am, 35 years later, learning something new and trying to incorporate that. And everyone's trying to learn at the same, drinking out of a fire hose, as they say.
It's fantastic, isn't it? In fact, we just brought into the university our first inaugural, first ever chief AI and data science officer, Dr. David Ebert.
Get him on our show, okay?
Okay, we'll get Dr. Ebert.
Give him a directive. Say, hey, you shall go on that show. No, I'm just teasing. He doesn't have to.
No, he's terrific, and he's looking at AI both from a research perspective, but also education,
right?
And honestly, operational, operationally, business functions. You know, how do we optimize our business functions using artificial intelligence.
And save jobs and keep jobs. You're the basically the biggest employer in the region. And I often say that if we took the University of Arizona out of the middle of Tucson, what do you got? You got an Air Force base and a couple of Walmarts. And so how important the university is to our thing. So AI is really important. Our guest for Wonder is and talking about the good things going on in research and development at the University of Arizona. Is Senior Vice President for Research and Innovation, Tomas de la Rubia. And talk a little bit about how the university and the collaboration, which has been ongoing for 100 years, but how that collaboration with, we talked about NASA, but how that is all happening. And you talked about how we have, healthcare and so forth. And so healthcare is something that everybody needs and has and is as part of. How do you work in that collaborative space with community partners, businesses, and the government?
It's absolutely essential that we partner with everybody, with the community, with the government, with businesses. In fact, we renamed my office, Research, Innovation, and Impact, to Research and Partnerships. And the reason for that was that innovation happens when you partner with the private sector, when you partner with the community. We discover things at the university. When we translate those discoveries through partnerships, we innovate. Mm-hmm. When we translate those discoveries through partnerships, we create impact. And so we renamed the Office Research and Partnerships because it's so critical to everything that we do. I'll give you an example. One of the initiatives that we launched at the university is around fusion energy. This is very, very aspirational.
I saw that article yesterday. Amazing.
It's really exciting what's going on out there. And like I said, in AI and healthcare and space and national security, we want to be on the leading edge of this transformation. Fusion is the energy that powers the stars. Mm-hmm. And given the scientific breakthroughs of the last few years, there is a real sense today of excitement around commercializing fusion energy. Mm-hmm. We want to be part of that enterprise. We want to be leaders in that area. We want Southern Arizona to become the hub of the future fusion energy industry. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not going to do that alone. Right. We have to partner. We have to partner with national laboratories, with the federal government, with private sector companies, with venture capital.
Other universities.
Right. And so we're creating those partnerships right now and really launching a very, very exciting effort to bring parts of that future industry here, the supply chain, the workforce development, everything that is going to be an integral element of what will be a multi-trillion dollar industry in the future globally, here in Tucson, in Arizona.
Great. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about the research and partnerships that are happening at the University of Arizona, what the future looks like, and what your focus will be here as you head into the semester getting started here pretty quickly, and what amazing things that are going on at the university. Our guest is University of Arizona Senior Vice President for Research and Partnerships, Tomas de la Rubia. This segment is sponsored by Crusoe's Italian Restaurant on Historic 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. You're listening to KVOI, and this is Wonder on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona, and we call it Wonder, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on Historic 4th Avenue and our good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. Our guest for this segment is talking about the good things going on in research and other things is the University of Arizona Senior Vice President for Research and Partnerships, Tomas de la Rubia. Again, good morning to you.
Good morning again.
And thank you so much for sharing your insights with us and so forth. During the break there, we were talking a little bit about our new president. He's been here a while now, but President Suresh Garamella. And What does it mean to have him? We were just talking about him being an engineer of all things, and him leading the University of Arizona and your executive team. And what's it like working for someone you've known for a long time?
Yes, I have had the pleasure really of knowing President Gary Mella for quite many years. Worked with him before coming here. And I have to tell you that for me, the opportunity to come here with him becoming the president was something I could not pass up. Mm-hmm. When I was interviewed and offered the position, the fact that he had come here, he's a visionary leader. Mm-hmm. He is an incredible scholar. He cares so deeply about his students. That really is his North Star. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, he's an academic, but he's also a fantastic administrator. He is a very fair person. Tough, mm-hmm. right? But also cares.
He calls balls and strikes, I gotta tell you.
He calls balls and strikes.
He's not afraid to announce them either. Like, oh, strike out!
Yeah. That's exactly right.
And that's a positive thing for a leader, to be able to do that and call it like he sees it. Yeah,
that's absolutely right.
And challenge all of us to do better.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And you know, like I said, he's also not just a visionary and a person of it's very strategic, very focused on the future, but he's also very focused on the present. Mm-hmm. He understands that an organization like the University of Arizona needs to have a strong management systems, a strong business systems, so that we understand where we're at and what we're doing, that we're responsible stewards of the public trust.
Right.
We take the resources that are given to us by our students, by the state, by others, and that we manage them responsibly.
I know that he's got a full plate, but one of the things that when I was with him, he was talking about is that whole business, how we account and how we share budgets and how we utilize the budgets with priority and how we maximize the return on the investment and so forth. Those are all important things. You mentioned one thing that is near and dear to my heart about what you said, what he's his North Star being students. What role do students, both undergraduate and graduate, play in their university's research enterprise, and how does their involvement and their educational experience help with these scholars that are doing this cutting-edge research on an international and national basis? How do these students fit into that?
Yeah, students are absolutely essential element to the research enterprise. Honestly, there is no research on a university campus if there are no undergraduate and graduate students doing the research. But beyond that, I tell you, for the president, he has laid out for the university our strategic imperatives, right? Mm-hmm. The North Star for the university. And as I said, number one is student success. Mm-hmm. And a key part of student success is having experiential opportunities where students can engage in research on campus, where they can engage in internships outside of campus that are research-based, because they learn about what they're going to do later in the future in society. I personally, when I was an undergraduate student and I had the opportunity to do research during those years, it transformed my life. Right. It is why I became a scientist. It mm-hmm. is why I am where I am. It was that experience that I had as an undergraduate to be able to do research in a laboratory. It just opened my mind, opened my eyes to what the future could be.
Great. Well, we call this wonder, and that kind of falls on the marketing campaign that's been going on. Steve Moore helped create that a couple of years ago, and normally these campaigns last about 3 to 5 years. Probably the marketing team got a new marketing communications vice president going to be working on probably something new in the coming months and years. But we call it wonder because that's a great description of the university. So I'm going to ask, I ask all my U of A people, what's one thing at the University of Arizona that you think is full of wonder?
I'll go back to where we started. I think our ability to participate and be discoverers of the universe, so how the universe mm-hmm. works from the very, very early stages of the universe to today, our place in the universe, right. I think that gives me tremendous wonder all the time. Every time I talk to our astronomers and astrophysicists and space scientists, I can't but wonder the OSIRIS-REx mission.
Oh, my goodness.
Bringing samples back from an asteroid out there in space, and being able to then use that to understand the origins of life.
Yeah.
That is wonder.
Answer that question. Why are we here? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chris Impey was on not too long ago, and I'm an astronomy junkie. I don't know anything about it, but it just fascinates me. And so I'm with you on that. I think that's really important. Hey, I got a couple of gift certificates for you and your staff for Caruso's, one of our wonderful sponsors. We thank you. Tomas de la Rubia, Diaz de la Rubia, Senior Vice President of Research and Partnerships at the University of Arizona. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for all you do for students at the University of Arizona.
Thank you, Ed. It has been a real pleasure to be here today.
Great. This is the Morning Voice on KVOI. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for joining us today on the Morning Voice.